Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. There's a lot of current research into the brain taking place in the world of medicine and science, seeking to learn how it works and why. One of the things that's emerging is that there are things we do to sap the brain's ability to function at full capacity. That can lead to any number of problems, one of which is the effect on compulsive behaviors, such as eating disorders. Our guest on today's program is a brain researcher who is in St. Louis specifically to talk about the brain and eating disorders. He's making a presentation tonight at the invitation of the Missouri Eating Disorders Association. Dr. Ralph Carson is the author of The Brain Fix, What's the Matter with Your Gray Matter? He's been involved in the clinical treatment of addictions for some 30 years, and he's a board member with the International Association of Eating Disorder Professionals. Also with us is Lynn Stark, co-founder, clinical nurse specialist, and program director at McCallum Place, the Eating Disorders Treatment Center, and Annie Seal, her daughter, is a former patient at McCallum Place. Thank you all so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Great to be here.
Ralph, let me begin with you. What keeps the brain from achieving its full potential?
I think there's several things. What most of us experience, if we take just a general view, is stress itself. Stress itself can cause destruction of nerve cells, especially chronic stress. Chronic stress means unresolved stress, worry. And if we break down cells, that we diminish our capacity to function at the highest potential. But also, there's many other things. We hear about these things called free radicals that are in the environment. We hear about inflammation. We have genetic disorders. But starvation, malnutrition, using drugs, all of these kind of make the brain function at less than maximum capacity.
But stress is the main culprit, you're saying?
I think if we look at every disease in general, stress is key.
But we all undergo stress, experience stress to one degree or another. At what point does this stress become harmful?
I believe it is. It's not so much stress, as you say, we're all going to be exposed to it. It's how we cope with stress. And by coping with it, we basically develop a resistance, resilience, so to speak, in terms of the destruction. But many people have so much stress, it overwhelms them.
You say the brain is very forgiving.
Exactly. And this is new information because when I was going through medical school, we were taught that once you lose a brain cell, it's gone forever and it's locked. But now we know that we can not only regenerate nerve cells, but we can rewire the brain. It's called neuroplasticity.
And how do we do that?
I think there's three phases this I think is important, and sometimes we forget the last two phases. The first phase is what is so instrumental in the therapist's role. This psychotherapy is what stimulates the change, and that means it's going to rewire itself. You need the stimulation or nothing will happen. But once it's stimulated, it's just like throwing seeds out. They're not going to grow unless there's the proper nutrients. So we have to spend more time and effort understanding how proper nutrition makes that increased brain cells and neuroplasticity. And what is lost a lot of times is the fact when this healing takes place is when you're sleeping, and to improve sleep.
Well, how much do we know about the nutrition we need to the brain's advantage?
We're just beginning to uncover how valuable nutrition is because of something that's happened in the last 15 years is called neuroimaging. Now we can actually look and see what the brain looks like, what it looks like when it's healing, what it looks like in disease. And prior to this, we were basically making assumptions based on subjective behavior. That means only known to the person experiencing it. So if you tell me you're happy, I can't really tell if you're happy. Now I can look in your brain and tell you if you're really authentically happy.
You also say that lifestyle behaviors affect the brain. In what way? What specific kinds of behaviors are we talking about?
Well, you know, I think that we have certain things, particularly like anxiety, depression. We have social relationships with other people. And we're actually designed, if you look at what makes humans different than other species, we're designed to have strong relationships and to have hope. And when people have hope, that is the key thing that basically makes the brain change.
I get the impression from all that you've said so far that it's impossible for any of us to go through life without doing our brain some considerable damage due to any one of a number of different factors.
And I think that fortunately, is our brain was designed to assume that in terms of survival. And when you look at the billions, we're talking billions of cells and connections, we've got a lot of reserve. And so you hear this disease that scares people like me that are getting older called dementia or Alzheimer's disease. And that's sort of when you run out of ability to think and so forth. So the longer you preserve your brain, the longer that it's going to keep functioning at maximal. So if you think about what is the thing that prevents Alzheimer's the most that we've discovered is ballroom dancing, as strange as that sounds, because you're stimulating thinking and movement at the same time.
So proper nutrition, lack of stress can have an impact on such things as dementia and Alzheimer's disease. Is it preventive or therapeutic or both?
Well, you know, when we talk about Alzheimer's, until recently, we really had no idea of how to stop it and to reverse it. And we're just beginning, because we understand the disease, to have hope that we can do certain things. And once we understand what caused the disease, we have that potential to kind of stop it and reverse it. And I think that's a big part of when we talk about eating disorders. That's the big kind of block that says we have to understand it. Once we understand it, we can have better interventions.
Now, your focus has for I don't know if it's the most part, but certainly a significant part, has been on eating disorders. What brought you to this intersection?
Well, you know, way back, if you can go back far enough into the 70s, I was very interested in preventive medicine, which was not a supporting field to get into. People didn't want to pay to feel better. And I started off finding that people would follow good nutrition, exercise, and sleep if they lost weight. So I started in the field we call obesity. But then we began to recognize this very kind of different and misunderstood disease we call eating disorders. And I was fascinated in that field and just followed that path. And 35 years later, I've just become obsessed with helping people with this disease.
Well, let me turn to Lynn now and get your input on what you've learned from people such as Ralph here with regard to brain function and eating disorders. Or is this such a new area that you're just learning yourself?
It's a new area that I'm learning myself. Actually, in my studies at school, working on my doctoral program, kind of incorporating animal-assisted therapy into work with eating disorders and looking at the impact that has on the brain and the chemicals that are released. So I think there's actually a lot of similarities on looking at the role of neurotransmitters, depletion of neurotransmitters, what happens to the brain when it is actually starved and its capacity to think in a flexible way. You know, so a lot of what we do at McAllen Place when we're looking at our meal monitor, like meal therapy and meal exposures and getting a person to a better nutritional state is looking at healing the brain. I actually just purchased Ralph's book and am reading it, and I'm learning as I'm reading it as well.
Well, my wife read it last night, and she found an awful lot of interesting material in there. Interesting. So you have been connecting the dots between nutrition, brain function, and the people that you're dealing with, your clients, your patients.
Correct.
Right, right.
It's looking at the biology behind the disease.
What have you seen, if anything? Again, this is kind of early on and you're part of this, but have you seen anything to make you think that positive things are happening?
Yes, I think when we see people, we look at a number of things. It used to be just looking at a weight number, but you know, kind of weight is part of it. Once we get to a person to a certain nutritional status, we see that their thinking can start to shift. They get out of what we call a small picture thinking, where they're looking only at details and they're able to shift and look at a bigger focus. And that seems to happen at kind of a certain, kind of it goes with weight, and we look at certain hormone levels to see where they are with those. And we notice that the person's ability to think in a different way starts to shift. And again, with that is the therapy that's helping to train their brain to think in those ways as well.
It's multifaceted.
Right.
It's not just that's one thing. But Ralph, there's something of an irony here, is there not, using nutrition to as a way to help resolve an eating disorder situation?
I think it's just becoming specific with the different nutrients. I think it's always been with eating disorders that first we eat, then we talk. Because when you're in a starved state, It's similar almost to if you're trying to explain to an alcoholic who is inebriated how to behave. Their brain's not functioning. When you're starving, you're in that same state. So you got to get the person to a state where they don't have distorted thinking, where they can process information. Now, the process then starts off in the particulars of the diet and what you eat, and it becomes key. Before that, it's just calories. You're just trying to retain that brain so it can function. So it's always been that nutrition has been an adjunct to the therapy, but now it's just getting more specific.
Would your approach to an alcoholic be the same as it would be to someone with an eating disorder, with bulimia? bulimia or anorexia?
Well, from the standpoint of my input in terms of nutrition and sleep, it's similar. And even if you had Alzheimer's or if you had trauma, it would be similar. But certainly in terms of the aspects, you're looking at almost a continuum. So if you look at a lot of people who have addictions, they would be what we would call risk takers. Okay, you look at people with anorexia, and they're more harm avoidant. So there's a whole different approach in terms of the psychotherapy. But the nutrition is the same because the cells are healing, and you do the same nutrition for both conditions.
Annie, let me turn to you, and thank you for being so patient and waiting. But you've gone through this experience with your daughter dealing
yes.
with this particular problem. What have you heard that really connects with your own personal situation, or does this kind of research, is it so new that it really has little application to your situation?
Well, what's interesting for me is the brain impairment was really the significant factor when I knew we were in deep trouble. You know, there were other factors that had sort of precursed the brain impairment, like my daughter thought she was fat when she wasn't. My daughter was having extreme anxiety over things that really didn't seem all that, you know, anxiety provoking to me. My daughter had huge emotional mood swings, and all of these things are confusing in teenagers, you know. But it was when the brain, when I saw the impact where she was no longer making grades or able to focus or able to really kind of navigate through her day because she couldn't think clearly, that I thought, wow, we are in big trouble. So it was really the brain issue that really got us into action, I think, and got her properly diagnosed.
And then what? And then what did you
well,
do?
Well, you know, so then we actually had a great doctor here in St. Louis who diagnosed her, and the advice we were given was aggressive, intensive treatment. Do not mess around with this disease. And I think because this disease is confusing, it's easy to dabble in treatment. But we took the advice and we aggressively pursued treatment for my daughter, and we got her into McCallum Place where she was refed. And as soon as she was refed, meaning she was getting nutrition, we saw a shift immediately in her mood and her behavior, and her sort of level of anxiety diminished. But she still wasn't on the road to really being well. She was just sort of back to a level that you could be around her, you know, because it really was – I mean, it's very traumatic. The behavior is very traumatic to the family. This brain impairment, this inability to think, really does reduce them to a state that they're not even really known.
I'm sure you're going to buy into exactly what Lynn said a moment ago with regard to nutrition is one thing, but the therapy is quite another and quite important.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the nutrition is first. Feed them first so that they can start to do the hard work of therapy. And, you know, it's interesting as I reflect on our journey, it really, you know, as she got well, as she was able to eat again, and as she was able to get the quality nutrition again, and we were able to really get out of the disease, the last piece of the puzzle when I really, really knew she was well was when she was tracking good grades again. And I just remember that. I thought, oh, my gosh, here we go again. We're back to A's, you know, because my daughter was one of those girls with an eating disorder. She had a EDNOS, which means a kind of a combination for us of anorexia and bulimia, which means she wasn't making straight A's when she was in the throes of this disease. She was really struggling to sort of keep things afloat. And here she is back, you know, and I thought, we're really on the road.
How long ago was all of this taking place?
4 years ago.
And how long did it take to get her back to those A's and back on the track?
I would say it was about a year. We were in treatment about, family. It is such a family disease.
Sure.
We were in treatment about 6 months, and then it was another 6 months before it really started to just feel like she was back, completely back, you know, to herself. And she's, you know, today just remarkably in what she's able to achieve and contribute. And, you know, we're really just really certain that she is what I call cured. So.
Yeah, well, we certainly hope that she
yeah.
is and that everybody is well now. We have to take a break. We'll do that. We're talking about the brain, actually, is where this conversation started, and the fact that it is quite a resilient organ, and that if it's treated properly, it can do a lot of wonderful things that perhaps a few years ago folks couldn't have anticipated happening. My guests in studio are Ralph Carson, the author of The Brain Fix, What's the Matter with Your Gray Matter? Also with us in studio is Lynn Stark, co-founder, clinical nurse specialist, and program director at McCallum Place, which deals with this particular disorder, and Annie Seal. Her daughter is a former patient at McCallum Place, and you just heard from her. We're going to come back and continue our conversation in just a moment. And, of course, we'd like to have you join us. Perhaps you've had experience with eating disorders and would like to learn more about what Dr. Carson is saying with regard to the brain and treatment. Our number, 382-8255, that's 382-TALK. Send us an email if you'd like to at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on Air. You can also reach us through Facebook. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation. We are talking about the brain and how working with it properly can affect so many of the things that might be problematic for us. And one of the things we're focusing on today is eating disorders, because there is clearly a connection, as I think we have established so far. My guest in studio is Ralph Carson, author of The Brain Fix, What's the Matter with Your Gray Matter? Lynn Stark, co-founder and program director at McCallum Place. Annie Seal's daughter was a patient at McCallum Place. We talk about quality nutrition, Ralph. What are we really talking about? I mean, are there specific things that we should be eating and or drinking to help the brain?
I think that the key words that we constantly talk about in terms of quality nutrition are the basics that go way back in time. And these three basics are really balance, variety, and moderation. And that's a very hard thing for people to do. People like to be extremes. So you see in dieting, it's leaving off something, leaving off carbohydrates, leaving off fat, leaving off meat. And that's where the eating disorder becomes a problem. It's not caused by dieting, but basically it precipitates it. And as people get into dieting, they want to do the extremes. You start missing any key nutrient, then the brain gets out of balance. So the explanations of what to do may seem very simple. It's motivating people to do them.
Sure. Well, how do you know? How would I know if my brain is in imbalance unless I were afflicted with, you know, an eating disorder, something very, very obvious?
I think the most obvious things that come to mind is to think about that the whole body needs energy, and each body part actually may use different sources of energy. And this becomes key with the brain because it only uses glucose. Now, people might be startled that sugar is so important, but that's all the brain uses. So a classic example is that your brain is not functioning. If you've ever, say, the middle of the day around 3 o'clock, you get tired, you start thinking fuzzy, you can't concentrate, you're irritable, and that means that your blood sugar's low. And when you have something like maybe a Coke or a cracker, you say, I feel better. Well, that's an example. The body doesn't have that energy. And a great example of this is a lot of people get headaches. And what most people don't know is the brain does not have any sensory nerves. So I can do an operation on you awake and you don't feel me kind of feeling around your brain. You say, but I feel pain in my head when I have a headache. That's because of the vessels have nerves. And so when your blood sugar gets low, those vessels dilate, and it's a change of those nerves irritation that causes the headache. Bringing more blood sugar to your brain.
Well, this would be a problem for a lot of us, I think, in what is becoming increasingly kind of a sugar-free world that we're living in here. We're trying to avoid it at every step.
And I think I'm glad you say that, because when I say sugar and you're not a scientist, you're thinking of table sugar or sweets. Mm-hmm. Sugar is what all carbohydrates, whether it's from a vegetable, a fruit, a potato, or candy, turn into. So what we do to make it more valuable and keep it centered is this combination of fiber, what we call complex carbohydrates plus sugar. It's a slow release as opposed to this quick up and quick down that you get with simple sugars. So you say, is there anything wrong with desserts? And people who struggle with eating disorders, they don't want to be in the same room with sugar. Mm-hmm. But if you have small quantities and combine it with other foods, it's perfectly okay. And that's a big part of what we do in eating disorders, is trying to make people get rid of these phobias around food. And we do this kind of exposure therapy. Say, listen, you're going to eat pizza, you're going to eat French fries. We don't want them to eat them all the time, but it's not going to kill you.
Mm-hmm. But it might make you gain weight.
If you have
weight,
too much.
Which is, yeah,
you know.
Right, right.
And I'll also use this analogy, and I think this is important. I'll also ask people, other than alcohol, what was the food or beverage that killed the most people? And you'll be surprised to hear last year it was water. You say, well, that's odd. Well, more people drowned and died. In other words, you can get too much of anything. Everything in moderation is okay, and that's a big lesson for people to learn. But you have to balance it. And so I think that what we're doing nutritionally is not to have these super supplements or have these crazy diets, but to make it livable.
Lynn, is this all making sense with regard to what you've been learning in recent years? And has it affected any dietary issues that you've had at McCallum Place?
I think as we're learning more about the nutrition process and exposure therapies, yes, like we do include for patients, there is a typical meal, and it may be their fear foods, their phobias. We support them in facing those, help them process that, watch their anxiety go down, and again, repeated exposures, gradually decreasing the anxiety. We do things like incorporate sweets and things that would be a feared food or a phobic food, a piece of pie, cake, a brownie. That's a small portion of dessert, and teach appropriate portion sizes and what's a normal meal plan. Patients do sometimes need a greater meal plan in order to get their weight gain, but again, it's the balance of all nutrients. You know, it's like fat is part of the meal, carbohydrates are part of the meal, protein is part of the meal.
I understand what you're saying with regard to the phobia and, you know, the concern that your patients might have with regard to gaining weight, which is basically why they're in the situation they're in. But what about the other nutritional part? The doctor would say, I think in his book, he does say that the Mediterranean diet is probably the best way for most of us to go. Is that something that you would incorporate or do incorporate?
I would need to know more about the Mediterranean diet in the book. Uh-huh. I haven't had a chance to get that far.
But so this is really a learn. This whole association this week with Ralph here is really perhaps a first step for you and your organization in terms of changing your approach to the way you do things.
Yes, I know we've started to modify our meal plan based on where patients are nutritionally and making sure we have the needed components together, and our dietary staff is working with Dr. McCallum on that.
Yeah. Annie, back to you and your family. And is your daughter still with you, or is she living independently? Or?
Yeah, she's in college.
Oh, she's in college.
She's living on campus. Mm-hmm.
Well, you can't really control what she's eating. I hope that in her first year she didn't gain the freshman 15 or whatever it's called.
You know, it was through McCallum Place where she really got schooled in nutrition. Mm-hmm. And so she is a great eater. I mean, she's a great cook. She's an organic farming major, sustainable ag major. And she works very hard to get a wide variety of color and nutrients on the plate every meal. She eats really, really well. Really extraordinary.
I would assume that you're going to take a look at Ralph's book as well to see some of the ideas that he has. Yeah. When you, at home, do you use the Mediterranean diet?
We use parts of it. I mean, we definitely look at a lot of olive oil, you know, in the raw state, and we look at the role of legumes and some of those other things. I think, you know, we've been interested in nutrition, well, really before my daughter was ill, but when she got ill, we became very interested. Yeah. So,
Ralph, would you think that Annie and her family are a little bit ahead of the curve if 4 years ago when their daughter was experiencing her problems, that they figured out that the brain was a big part of it?
I think they are. I think we need that kind of educational and concern to basically look at it. And I think that this idea of eating has, and you mentioned the Mediterranean, it's sort of like has this exotic feel to it, but it just is common sense when you believe it. And if you think of the brain, let's say, for example, one of the main aspects of the Mediterranean diet is having fish oils, what we call omega-3s. And if you take the brain, you take the water out, most of your brain is fat, and most of it is omega-3s. So it just becomes incorporating all of this into common sense. So as I'm a dietitian, and RDs know that we've kind of evolved from this kind of food pyramid to more towards a Mediterranean diet. And you say, well, that's just common sense. Eat lots of vegetables and fruits, whole grains, minimize our meats and fats, but don't leave them out. So it's really, you say, well, this is very common sense. And it shows that when we look at longevity, which everybody wants to live a long life, that people who follow this pattern live a long life.
Yeah, you say, as a matter of fact, in your book, that a healthy brain can prolong your life.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. We have a number of people who want to get into the conversation, so let's bring them in. We'll start with John calling from North St. Louis. John, thanks for waiting. You're on the air. John, I'll tell you what. We're having a lot of difficulty hearing what you're saying. If you wouldn't mind calling back, we'll take your call as soon as you do, but we just can't hear you. So let's move on to Mary calling from St. Louis. Mary, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. Long story short, when I was 16, I was poisoned with strychnine, and I seized for about 6 hours and then was in a coma for several days. When I emerged from the coma, after relearning how to communicate, I noticed I had these compulsive tendencies towards food. One specific instance I remember very vividly is having an argument with my hand. This sounds ridiculous, but I was holding a brownie. It was 11 o'clock at night, and I was like, I know I don't need to eat this brownie right now, but my hand kept pushing it towards my mouth, and I ate it. And I felt like I couldn't stop myself from doing that. And I find that the more often this happens, the easier it is for me to just ignore the logical part of my brain saying, this is not healthy, this is not something that you need to do, and just continue to eat. I'm wondering what advice you guys would have is in terms of treatment for me.
Doctor, let's start with you on that, and then I'll turn it over to Lynn, see how she would handle it.
Well, in all fairness, I'm not exactly familiar with this presentation. It is that when we look at any behavior, and that would be a compulsion, doing something in spite of negative consequences, that it would basically be a almost conditioned response after a while, that you would more interact in terms of therapeutically than really seeing it as a nutritional imbalance.
Lynn, your thoughts about this particular case?
I had the same thought. It sounded more like a compulsion. So, again, I don't know if it's related to the injury that her brain sustained. And it sounds like exactly what she's describing is the more she resists that and she's able to, the less frequently or less intensely that occurs, which is kind of what we would do with an exposure therapy, is help a person work through that and stop that.
She would probably be well advised then to talk to somebody about this, I would guess. Would that be a recommendation?
I think that would be helpful.
Yeah, all right. By the way, we have a tweet here, Annie, directed at you, saying, as someone who is struggling with eating disorders, Annie just gave me so much hope. So you and your daughter have apparently already helped somebody, so that's good.
Right. Wow, thank you. Right. Glad.
Let's go back to the phones. And Daniel in Florissant, thank you for waiting. You're on the air. Are you there? Well, apparently not. We'll try Brad calling from St. Louis. Brad, are you with us?
I am. I was just curious about the different types of eating disorders that there might be. For instance, my wife and her family seem to eat consistently without even knowing they're eating. Like, for instance, they'll be having a conversation and they'll grab a cinnamon roll and they'll eat it and they're not even cognizant of the fact that they just ate something. Is that an eating disorder?
I'll give my input. It's not the classic eating disorder. Sometimes we kind of interchange this word eating disorder and disordered eating, so that you have these behaviors that lead to consequences. So a lot of times this is an habituated response that someone does. And the way the brain's designed is we either avoid pain or seek pleasure, and we respond quickly to things that taste good that have either high sugar or high fat. And it's almost like if you have an inch, you scratch it, you basically have a discomfort or want to be excited, or you change your mood, you reach for something to eat. So it's a habitual response that you know, by classical conditioning, you can kind of do something else. You distract yourself or you do another behavior to replace that.
This would be something that maybe people would learn when they're young from their parents or something like that, probably.
It could be something conditioned, but it could also be kind of a latent vulnerability that you have these stress responses and you just react by finding some pleasure. So it could be conditioned in early stages, but it could also be brought on by stressful events in your life.
I just saw it as being odd because the whole family does it, and it's something I've never seen in anyone else. So, you know.
Well, families have a lot to do in terms of conditioning in the early development of all of us. And we have these things in our bodies we call mirror neurons, and we mirror what other behaviors are and who are you in the presence of most of you growing up or your parents. So it is typical we follow other responses.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Thank you for calling. Annie, is this ringing any bells with you, this particular part of the conversation?
In terms of compulsive behavior, mm-hmm. There's a lot of compulsive behavior that goes with an eating disorder. The anxiety really provokes a lot of activity, unnecessary activity, things that seem sort of strange in the house. But I'm sort of just still dwelling a little bit just on that somebody feels like they're hopeful, because I think there is a lot to be hopeful about with this disease, and I think that, you know, it doesn't have to be a chronic lifelong condition, that there really is full treatment available, and just need to pursue it and fight it.
If someone's seeking treatment, Lynn, what should they do for an organization like yours or others? What's a first step?
For us, you can call and talk to one of our intake specialists. They're available 24/7. You have to call a cell phone after a certain hour to be able to talk to them. And they will try to gather baseline information on what the struggles are currently. If necessary, set up a time for you to come in and meet with them so we can get more in-depth information from you. And we have a full array of services, starting with our outpatient services, that we use some of our evidence-based treatments with cognitive behavioral therapy, dialectical behavioral therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy kind of weight loss management program, as well as treatments for anorexia and bulimia, full medical staff, through our intensive outpatient programs all the way to residential care.
How long typically would it take for someone from the time they make contact until they're, quote, cured? Or are you ever cured?
I guess there could be a debate on that. Yeah. I believe that, yes, recovery is possible and people live lives without the interfering thoughts and interfering behaviors of their eating disorder. You know, if you say there's a genetic basis to it, you know, it might be that I have had my eating disorder and I'm cured. I'm not struggling with those thoughts, but I may always have the predisposition in a stressful situation. Mm-hmm. Wow, food doesn't bring me pleasure, so that's easy to avoid. You know, I think the path for recovery can vary. It can be a year. I think we've said on average about 7 years for people, but it really does vary. I don't think there's just as there are. There's many types of eating disorders.
Sure. Give us your phone number, and then we'll put it on our website as well so folks can get to that, and also a link to your website.
It would, it's McAllenPlace.com is the website, and then the phone number is 314-968-1900.
Okay. All right. That's the 968-1900 with the 314 area code for McAllen Place. We'll put the link to the website on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Time for us to take another break. Let's do that. We'll continue our conversation and take your phone calls when we come back. So those of you who are waiting, please be patient. We'll be back in a minute or so to continue this discussion. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation. John, we tried to contact a little while ago on telephone. Didn't work out, but this is what he wanted to talk about, and I hope I pronounce some of the things he has here properly. Has the guest heard of superfoods, including mangosteen, Greek greens, barramundi, or turmeric? What do you think?
Yeah, I've heard of these, and what we talk about when we talk about superfoods, to make it simple as I can, foods have protection. They protect themselves from the environment, things like insects and molds and droughts and ultraviolet light. And these protections are called phytonutrients. And so when things are grown in very difficult situations, the one that has the most phytonutrients we found is a berry that's grown in the Brazil Amazon called acai berry. It's so stressed, it has lots of phytonutrients. Mm-hmm. So that, yes, but then you can also, if you eat a variety of highly pigmented foods, you're going to get the same thing. And what most people don't know, as soon as you pick a fruit or a food, that it begins to break down those phytonutrients when it's picked. So even though you want to kind of, you know, transport vegetables from South America to eat them fresh, it actually in the winter is better to have frozen because it stops that breakdown of those phytonutrients.
Well, what about various vitamins? I know you're a proponent of fish oil for reasons you outlined a little while ago. Can we accomplish a lot of what we need to accomplish through various vitamins and supplements?
Well, from the perspective of what we're trained in nutrition, that ideally in a perfect world, if we ate healthy, we wouldn't need them. But we don't eat healthy, and we also find that we don't know everything. So I look at vitamin and mineral supplements as an insurance, just in case we don't get enough. Because if you miss one specific nutrient, if it's like selenium, that can disrupt the whole balance. So it's just sort of like an insurance program.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. We have Lucia calling from the Central West End. Thanks so much for being with us again. How are you?
I'm well, Don. It's Lucia. But that's okay. I still adore you, Don. I haven't called in a long time, so, you know, I never really get upset with you. So, two questions. I like making fruit smoothies. Can I get something to help my poor little brain get brainier? And are there foods, not necessarily generally speaking, but specific foods for specific people that might not really be good for the brain?
Well, I'll address that. I think she said smoothies. Is that my understanding? Yes. And mixing things like juices and vegetables and smoothies is an excellent way to get this kind of powerful, what we call phytonutrients and antioxidants. So that's a great addition to your food plan. Things that are detrimental to the brain, we find particularly are psychoactive drugs. But they're not drugs, you don't think, because you don't even think of caffeine like a drug, but it is. And it really disturbs the balance. And so people who are...
Caffeine.
Okay. The problem is that it basically disturbs sleep, and that's when your brain heals. So if you're wanting your brain to get better, it's basically a slow process if you have caffeine. And also artificial sweeteners, and not for the reasons that they're negative and they cause any chemical reactions. It's just that they trick the brain, and they trick the brain to thinking you're getting sugar, so it dumps insulin, and insulin can be very destructive to your brain over long term. So actually, artificial sweeteners in terms, you better eating small amounts of sugar.
Okay. Thank you.
Licia, thanks so much. I hope I got it right that time. Let's bring in Eric calling from St. Louis. Eric, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Hi. I have two comments that I'd like to have your guests reply to. The first one is in small college towns, for students in a high-stress environment, it's kind of pervasive and systemic for people to be going to fast food and to be having a poor diet, and it just kind of becomes part of the culture. And I was wondering what their thoughts for that were. And then the second comment is directed towards the doctor. I was wondering if you could comment on acute tryptophan depletion and how cues can affect the reward pathways in the brains and how poor foods can become addictive.
Okay, let's see. Let's start with the fast foods. Fast foods, again, it's a difficulty if that's the main source of foods and eating quickly, because they contain things that get in excess amounts, and particularly things like trans fats and saturated fats and high concentrations of sugar. So that I think fast foods are trying to move towards having options that you can get salads and you can get other choices. And a good thing to do is to, like this lady was saying, make smoothies. And you don't need that much food, but just always be sure you're getting, you know, vegetables and fruits. With the tryptophan, it's a very interesting thing, because tryptophan is a precursor. What that means, it's what makes these neurotransmitters that calm us down. This particular neurotransmitter is called serotonin. And so a lot of antidepressants work on serotonin to keep more of it to make you calm. Unfortunately, taking it in foods is not going to make you make more serotonin, because the tryptophan competes with other things that are in proteins. People who are addicted to sweets, what happens is they get this simple sugar, and that puts out insulin, and it blocks the competitor. So tryptophan makes more serotonin temporarily and makes you feel calm, and then you kind of withdraw from that. Now you need more. So there is this kind of process. It's not a chemical addiction. There's a process that makes people kind of want that comfort from, we call them mama foods, foods that basically are love, warmth, comfort, security. They calm you down, and just thinking about them releases the serotonin and makes you calm. A better thing to do would be really to control your blood sugar, and that's going to produce the same kind of even keel in your brain for serotonin and tryptophan.
Lynn, have you found, and the number of people over the years that you've dealt with and helped, that there is a particular a gender or age profile? I mean, we tend to think of it, I think, in terms of young women having an eating disorder problem more than any other group. Is that accurate?
Those that are presenting for treatment right now, yes, are primarily women. We've seen the age expand up into the 60s, and there's actually an increase in the older population that's coming forward. I think many more men struggle with it and don't necessarily seek help or aren't identified readily, because people associate it as being a women's disease. I think it's still primary onset. We see a lot happen in puberty when the hormones are shifting. And for young girls, that's often when their body types are changing quite a bit. And you can kind of maybe set off the precursors if everything is right. But again, the age range I have seen actually expand quite a bit and going into the older and more males.
Ralph, what do you make of that with regard to the brain and age and gender?
Well, certainly there is we're becoming aware of that it's a larger scan that we're involved with. But as Lynn said, what happens is in puberty you start putting out estrogen, which is making these brain changes. So it's almost a 10-to-1 ratio of females to males, and 40% are going to be aware to us that they have eating disorders around those teen years. However, what's happening is puberty hasn't changed much since 1970, maybe from 12.5 to 12 years old. What has changed? So we're seeing estrogen coming up earlier in children at age 7. You get what we call breast budding and things of that nature. And so you have, when you think about puberty and young girls who have images, that they are going to gain anywhere from 30 to 40 pounds in 4 years and change their percent body fat from 13 to 8%. And if any female gained that much weight or had that much change in that short a period of time and they're vulnerable, it's going to trigger this disease. So there is still this leaning towards primarily this kind of adolescence that is the majority. But certainly we see it in males, people of color. We see it happen as early. We've had incidences as early as 6 years old. We have people that are well into their 60s that have this disease.
Annie, with regard to images, in your own particular case, in your daughter's case, how much did media and media images, do you think, play a role in your daughter's problem? We hear so much about trying to look like the models in Vogue, for instance.
Yeah. You know, I think that there's an expression that, you know, genetics load the gun, but culture pulls the trigger with this disease. And I do. I feel like I just remember, you know, my daughter was raised during the Britney Spears years, where your midriff was showing and your clothes were small. And I feel like it was really negative and really difficult to combat, you know, as a parent to teach them that, you know, appearance, celebrityness, that those things are second to who you are as a person, because it is so pervasive. So we do need to change the culture for young girls and for boys too now.
Lynn, I'm sure you're seeing the same thing and hearing the same thing.
It is. I see it as being so hard when patients are trying to recover as well. You know, they're terrified. We're asking them to do something that's horribly terrifying for them 5 or 6 times a day in eating, talking to them about getting their bodies to a healthy place. Their brain is not processing in a normal way, and they're constantly bombarded with messages that losing weight, being thin equals happiness, success, and all the great things in life. So I think it really does, from a recovery standpoint, propose barriers for many of our patients as well.
There's that brain at work again, Ralph.
Exactly. And I think what we're talking about self-image is that, you know, we have hundreds of girls that are exposed to the same images. But why do 1 in 200 develop an eating disorder? So there's this vulnerability. But if it does happen, there's something in the brain we call an allosteric lock, that it locks into their brain their size. So they can't see themselves the size. So you may be amazed, how could this girl be so thin and not see that she's thin? She can recognize your okay shape, but she can't recognize herself. So this brain is operating in this disease.
What is it Bobby Burns said? Or would sub God the gift to give us to see ourselves as others see us? Right?
There you go.
Back to the phones. Let's bring in Ellen calling from Kirkwood. Ellen, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you. I am calling in response to the young woman who said she was in a coma for a while and then had the strange experience of her hand wanting her to eat, and then her more conscious self, you know, not wanting it. And I'm calling because I speak from some experience. I'm an occupational therapist, and I've worked with a lot of people who are recovering from comas or strokes or things like that. What I've seen is that sometimes these primitive reflexes come out stronger than they ever would, such as hand-to-mouth reflexes. And then it might not be so much an eating disorder, but just a more dominant flexor tone or, you know, primitive reflex of hand to mouth. And then some of the treatments that I've seen help is doing a lot of extension and reaching outward exercises with some resistance. So you would like take a rubber band and put it around your fingers and work hard to straighten and spread out your fingers really hard, and do exercises that would make your elbow straighten against resistance and make your shoulder and whole arm reach out to the side in a whole extensor pattern, which is, you know, balancing that flexor hand-to-mouth pattern. And I just wanted to assure that young woman that I have seen something like that before. I'm a therapist with over 30 years of experience, and that's why I wanted to call in.
Well, Alan, thank you so much for doing so. I hope that caller is still with us. Any comment to make on her remarks?
Well, I think that's very good, and I appreciate her sharing that. The only thing that I would further ask is remember she said a brownie, so I could see it was just the motion or the. But I'm wondering why the brownie.
Well, yeah, we certainly can't do a lot of diagnosis over the radio, that's for sure. But Ellen, thank you for the call. Let's bring in Chad calling from St. Louis. Chad, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
But I'm wondering why the brownie.
Turn down your radio, Chad.
I certainly can't do a lot of diagnosis over there.
Chad, turn down your radio so we can get in sync here. Chad, we've lost him. If you want to call back, Chad, do so. Let me make mention of the fact, and I meant to do this earlier, but Dr. Carson is going to be making a presentation later this evening at Washington University's Siegel Hall. That's taking place from 5:30 to 8:30 this evening, and that's following a panel discussion, as I understand it, at 2:30 this afternoon. That also taking place at... At Siegel Hall?
Well, the panel discussion is taking place at another classroom at WashU.
Okay.
So we're bringing together healthcare professionals to talk specifically about eating disorders.
And is anyone invited to participate in all of that?
The panel discussion, not as much, but if they're interested in providing perspective on eating disorders, they can go to the MoEatingDisorders.org website, and there's a landing page there in the events section that tells them how they can participate. On that.
And we do have a link to that website on ours at stlpublicradio.org. I'd just like to step back from eating disorders for just a moment because, Doctor, with so much discussion these days about PTSD and concussions and football players, I'm just wondering, you know, are there things that can be done to help heal people who are in this these categories?
You know, this is a new science, really. It's very exciting, and there are some examples, and there's some examples in the book, of people who had severe injuries, trauma to their brains that years later they've been able to kind of move and talk. And it's just new science, but it's very exciting. And again, it lends us hope that this can happen because of regeneration, yes.
Now, this regeneration is something, once again, that can be assisted through diet.
I think we hypothesize it can, but be actually trace this, the whole mechanism over time, it would be very difficult to say here's a peer-reviewed paper that proves this. But certainly it has the structure and function and the science behind it to say this is very possible.
And what one of the callers mentioned stroke. What is the potential for healing stroke victims?
You know, we have what we call individual case studies where there have been significant changes with people in terms of recovering to some degree and having a better quality life because of all the, you know, interventions both medically and physical therapy and psychotherapy as well as nutrition and sleep. So it's very hopeful for the future.
But we're on the early part of that
early
path.
Early part, yes.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Chad is back with us. We have just enough time, Chad, I think, to get you in, but it's going to have to be quick. Go ahead.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.
Go ahead.
I don't work with people that have eating disorders per se, but I do work with special needs children, and I do take advantage of some brain plasticity principles in terms of helping the brain learn and grow and do its job better. You know, we take action in the world based on our self-image. And if you boil the self-image down to its essence, it's comprised of four components. It's the thinking self-image, the feeling or sensing self-image, the emoting or showing emotion self-image, and the moving self-image. And in terms of those being separate, the only times those are separate, and from what I understand, are when we speak about them, because in terms of the brain science, they're all intertwined, and the same kind of processes that control thinking and cognitions are the ones that control movement.
All right, Chad, you're going way too long, I'm afraid. Have you heard enough, doctor, that you want to respond to him? It has to be quick.
I don't know.
Chad, I'm sorry we didn't get you earlier, but time is really getting away from us. Let's put a cap on this, and I'll go across the table. Lynn, starting with you, what's the takeaway you want folks to go away with from this program?
I think understanding that with eating disorders that there is the biological component as well as the therapy component, that we're still learning a lot, and treatments have transformed tremendously in the last 5 years.
There's certainly hope, and more hope than ever for people with the problem before. Annie, a final thought from you?
Yeah, just to reiterate, there is so much hope around this disease right now. There are so many new things we're learning. There's so many things that families can do to help their loved ones get well. And just... you know, fight the fight as hard as you can if you've got it.
Doctor, 30 seconds for a final thought.
I think a holistic approach like they use at McAllen Place, where they're not only using the latest in psychotherapy but also nutrition, mindfulness, exercise, and sleep.
That's Dr. Ralph Carson, who is the author of The Brain Fix, What's the Matter with Your Gray Matter? He is going to be appearing this evening from 5:30 to 8:30 at Siegel Hall at Washington University. And as we have mentioned earlier, we have information about that on our website. Thank you so much, Ralph Carson, for being with us. It's been a pleasure.
And enjoyed it.
Keep up the good work. Lynn Stark of McAllen Place, thank you for being with us. And Annie Seal, thank you also for being with us. Good to see you again. We chatted a couple of years ago when you were dealing with your daughter's problem.
Thanks, Don.
Glad that worked out so well for everybody.
Thank you so much.
Thank you all. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with Calvin Trillin about his new book of poetry about the 2012 presidential campaign. Just when you thought all the talk about that campaign was over, here we go again. But Calvin Trillin tomorrow. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.